If you suffer from low back pain, you're not alone. Almost everyone will experience back pain at some point. And in fact, according to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, Americans spend $50 billion a year on low back pain. And often those who suffer cannot perform their daily activities. Commonly, they have to miss work. And in fact, it is the most common cause for employees to miss work. I'm Kermit Poling. Thank you for tuning in for this edition of Health Matters. And joining us in the studio this evening is Dr. Randall Brewer, a physician at River City's Interventional Pain Specialists in Shreveport, to discuss the causes of low back pain and some of the treatments. Dr. Brewer received his medical degree from the Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport, postgraduate training at Emory University, Duke University, the Mayo Clinic, and a whole lot more. And you can join in this conversation with your questions this evening at 800-552-8502. Dr. Brewer, thank you so much for being here this evening as part of Health Matters.
Kermit, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to answer folks' questions and talk a little bit about a subject that is near and dear to the hearts of many folks who suffer with low back pain.
Just to start off, can you explain, because everybody I think knows what the lower back is, but maybe doesn't understand the structures within what we really consider to be the low back. Can you define that for us?
You know, that's a really good question, because a lot of folks will talk about back pain, and it can be anywhere from the back of the head all the way down to what's called the coccyx or the tailbone. When people describe a backache, typically the low back is the area that's around the waist, mm-hmm. and doctors will describe that as lumbar pain or low back pain. Thoracic pain is pain that's basically between the shoulder blades, all the way up to about the lower cervical spine, and that's really considered the neck.
Right.
But when we talk about low back pain, we're really talking about the area that's around the waist, extending up about 6 inches and down about 6 inches into the upper buttocks. That's what we would consider the low back. Another anatomical question that can be confusing for doctors and patients alike is what we consider the hip. The hip, typically, folks will consider the hip as part of the low back. And so if you reach around your waist and you sort of reach down into your back pocket or on the side of your leg, for example, a lot of folks will say, that's my hip. My hip hurts. And certainly part of the hip joint extends out into where the buttock area is and out to the side of the low back. But the hip joint itself is deep within the pelvis, and it's closer to the front of our body than it is the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we say we have hip pain, it can be the hip itself, or it can actually be part of the low back. And so that's important for us to distinguish. It's really important to tell your doctor exactly where you hurt. Point to the spot. Because the language can be confusing, and it's a good point that you bring up. Always let the doctor know exactly where the pain is, and where does it go? Does it start in one spot and do what we call radiate to a different area from where it starts?
Right. I know frequently we hear from someone that that they've strained their back, which seems to probably include a whole lot of different things. What are they usually referring to when someone says, well, I've strained my back? What is that typically?
The causes of a back strain are theoretically anything in the back that hurts can be a cause of a strain. We have muscles, we have ligaments. We have these anatomical structures in the low back called discs, which are basically rings of cartilage that help to support the back biomechanically, but they also help to absorb loads on the back. A lot of times a back strain can be a pulled muscle, or it could be actually some of that disc material that's cracked.
Mm-hmm.
As we get older, the material in the disc can lose some of what we call elasticity or fluidity within it. And so as the fluidity level drops, the disc becomes drier, sort of like any other sort of solid structure that can contain fluid. As the fluid is extracted from it, the tissue is going to become drier, and it can actually crack, especially on the outsides.
Mm-hmm.
So those are called tears. A lot of times when someone has a pulled back or a strain in their back, it can be a tear of that disc material. That's usually a fairly severe episode of pain.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of folks will describe that as a really sharp, intense pain that doesn't go away very quickly. That'll last a day or two. And many people describe that as my back went out, say over the weekend.
Right, right.
And they may have to miss work the first couple of days of the week. Now, a back strain typically is something that doesn't last a full day, and that is believed to be more of a ligament issue, or it can be a muscular issue. A number of things can lead to that. It's important to think about, you know, is this something that I need to address with a physician? Most people actually who have back pain don't see doctors for it. They, you know, they take care of their bodies by doing core strengthening. You know, things like yoga, Pilates, cardiovascular exercise can help to prevent recurrent back strains and things along those lines. The other thing is folks will use medications like ibuprofen or acetaminophen, over-the-counter pain medicines that can help to control, you know, minor aches and pains in other places as well in the low back. But if it's a recurrent, persistent problem, it's probably a good idea to have it checked out, at least have your primary doctor take a look over you, make sure that your general health conditions aren't in a situation where they could be contributing to your back pain, or there are no so-called red flags present in your history on your exam.
Okay, the number to call with your question this evening is 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. This is Health Matters this evening, and Dr. Randall Brewer is my guest. We're discussing more or less specifically low back pain. We hear a lot about compression fractures. Someone will mention that they suffered a compression fracture in their back. What exactly are those, and then how do you treat that?
Compression fractures really are in two basic categories. The most common cause of a compression fracture is going to be osteoporosis, which is the lack of calcium metabolism in bone that is to a degree where it's supporting bone structure in a normal way. People who are prone to compression fractures are the elderly. They occur more often in females than they do in males. They occur more often in Caucasian or European descent females than males, and they occur more often in folks who have a low body mass or a low muscle mass. The primary treatment for compression fractures is going to be to address the ultimate root cause, which is the osteoporosis. Most women who are at high risk for osteoporosis, through their primary care physician or rheumatologist, have regular surveillance for the thickness of their bones or the hardness of their bones, and that's called bone mineral densitometry. And that's something that's performed. There's a scoring mechanism such that once the score reaches a certain range, the doctor will determine whether the score is at the level where treatment needs to be instituted. Mm-hmm. The treatments can be anywhere from calcium and vitamin D all the way up to agents which actually take calcium into the bone and sequester it there pharmacologically. In terms of this fracture specifically, when a compression fracture occurs as a result of osteoporosis, the most common treatment is going to be rest at that level. Mm-hmm. Pain medications are going to be important. The compression fracture can cause compression actually of nerves or the spinal cord, and it's really important for a patient to tell the physician, you know, I'm having numbness and tingling, or the pain is associated with loss of bowel function or bladder function or loss of strength. That would mean that there's a component of the fracture that could be extending into the spinal canal itself, and that would require an emergency operation. Mm-hmm. So that's really, really important to pay attention to. These fractures usually occur fairly quickly. They can occur spontaneously, and they can be recurrent, especially if the osteoporosis is aggressive. The other form of a compression fracture is post-traumatic or associated with trauma. And with any sort of trauma, even with a car accident or falling from an elevated height, the spine absorbs the force in such a way that the vertebral bodies are not able to absorb the load like the discs are, and they can basically fracture from the inside out. And so those traumatic compression fractures are the ones that are at the highest risk, actually, of compressing the spinal cord and other structures, and emergency surgery can be required for those as well. When surgery is not indicated, ice, pain medications, and usually some sort of bracing for the back is required to keep the fractured pieces in place, if you will, as normal healing occurs. Folks who do have osteoporosis are going to require a more prolonged healing time because the bone is not going to be deposited down as efficiently and as reliably as in the post-traumatic setting.
Okay, the number to call if you have a question this evening is 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502, to be part of our discussion on low back pain, its causes, and treatments, of course. And we do have our first caller who's on the line right now. This is going to be Bill from Shreveport. Thank you for holding, and thank you for making your call. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Kermit, and thanks, Doc, for taking the program. I got a question. I'm 56, and every morning I get up from the bed extremely stiff, and I can't hardly bend over at all. Now, as the day goes on, of course, that loosens up. But what causes that? And secondly, is it the mattress? Thank you.
Bill, thanks for calling in. I appreciate your question. It's a complaint or a condition that we hear about quite often. Pain and stiffness generally point to issues in the back that can be related to joints. We have these joints in the back that are called facet joints. They sort of look like thickened shingles or three-dimensional joints that basically allow the back to turn. They bear loads when we stand up straight. As opposed to the discs, which are going to bear loads when we are bending and sitting for the most part. The pain and stiffness that happens overnight is because the joints are not necessarily making the same amount of fluid that they would be making if we're up and about. And so as the joints sort of dry up a little bit, the pain fibers within those joints, especially the parts of the joints that don't have as much cartilage as other areas in our body, the pain fibers are going to be a bit more sensitive because there's not as much lubrication and there's going to be more friction, which stimulates the pain fibers. And so as we get up and we start to move around, the cells within the joints that are responsible for making the fluid are becoming more active. The fluid's going to lubricate the joints and the joints are going to become less painful. A lot of times the treatment of arthritis in the back can be quite effective. The treatments that we use for the most part are going to start with anti-inflammatory drugs in folks who can take those if they're not contraindicated from the medical point of view. Drugs like ibuprofen, naproxen, and there are a number of drugs on the market that can do that. In general, those are the types of drugs that have to be taken on a regular basis in order to have enough levels in the system to maintain anti-inflammatory activity. Classically, pain and stiffness in the morning is related to the joints. There are other less common causes of pain and stiffness in the morning that could be related to the discs or the muscles in the back. If you've had a set of regular back x-rays done, usually your primary care doctor or the doctor that reads the x-ray can let you know if you're developing any arthritis in the back. The mattress is a great question. If you have a mattress that works for you, I would say congratulations, because you know, most of us tend to have a favorite mattress, whether it's extra soft or a pillow top or a firm mattress. I will comment that most people who have back trouble and find a mattress that works for them, they tend to say that it's a stiffer mattress or one that has a bit more of a firm surface that does better for them. Sadly, we don't have what we call randomized controlled studies in folks who have back pain to determine whether a nice expensive mattress is going to be any more effective in treating your back pain than anything else. I usually recommend that if you're interested in spending the money using a mattress, make sure that you have all your questions answered by the manufacturer. If they claim that the mattress helps back pain, ask them for data. Ask them for what sort of evidence do you have to support your claim that this mattress is going to improve your back pain. There are a lot of mattress producers that have produced data, and they can provide that to you. Commercials and happy customers are very common, and those are certainly good to hear. But from the physician's standpoint, I'd like to look at data and get really good information before I would recommend that someone spends a significant amount of money on a specialized mattress.
Okay, the number to call this evening, 1-800-552-8502. You can participate in this evening's Health Matters discussing lower back pain. And I know we have some people that have called with questions that wanted to remain anonymous and not come on the air, and that's fine. We'll get to yours in a while here. We do have a caller from Arkansas right now, however, and we will go to that right now. So this is Hector. Hector, go ahead with your question this evening.
Yeah, I would ask the doctor that sciatica is related to the lower back, and how would you treat it?
Referring to sciatica?
Yes, sir.
Hector, thanks for calling. Sciatica is a term that is probably the most commonly known scientific term by the lay public. It's a term that describes the sciatic nerve. The sciatic nerve is what we typically consider the largest nerve in the body. It's a big bundle of nerves that comes together really in the buttock. It doesn't come together in the back. But the issue with the sciatic nerve, how it relates to back pain, is that there are a number of fibers in that nerve that come out between the bones in the back that come together to make the nerve, sort of like several roads coming together to make an interstate. And so if one of the roads, for example, is blocked off, it's going to cause problems not only in that road, but a problem in the interstate as well. And so if there's a nerve that is pinched, so to speak, or if it's inflamed between some of the bones in the back, perhaps by a slipped disc or a herniated disc, it can cause some problems down into that nerve as well. So since the nerve starts in the buttock by other individual nerves that originally start in the low back, the pain of sciatica, so to speak, will go all the way down the leg. And so patients who complain of sciatica typically also have back pain, and then that pain will radiate from an area in the back. Typically it's in the low back just above the waistline, and it will go all the way down the leg into the buttock, even into the calf and into the foot. Hector, you asked how do we treat sciatica? And that's a question that I hear a lot. The first treatments are usually having folks try an anti-inflammatory medication. A lot of times the pain sort of forces us to rest and sort of get into a position that's not going to aggravate the nerve. Most people prefer to lie in somewhat of a semi-inclined position so that we're not sitting doubled up, so to speak, and we're not flat on our backs. I encourage people to maintain as much mobility as possible during a flare-up of sciatica, because what research has shown is that as the body is able to adjust to the pinched nerve or the inflammation, it tends to go away a little bit more rapidly. If the pain doesn't go away in about 24 hours or so with using the anti-inflammatory medications and a little bit of gentle reduction in your activities, you probably want to let your doctor know about it. And there are a number of treatments that have been proven to be somewhat effective, or at least that are commonly used. Those could include, you know, stronger pain medications, or they could include cortisone injections around the nerve or cortisone anti-inflammatory medications by mouth. Usually an episode of sciatica clears up within a few days. Less commonly, it takes more than a week or so. After about 5 to 6 days, if the pain is progressing, which means if the pain is getting worse, if it's associated with weakness, especially inability to pick the foot up, your doctor's probably going to want to do some imaging of your back. The most sensitive image for looking at structures in the back is going to be what we call an MRI. That's a magnetic resonance imaging study, which is basically going to allow us to visualize the discs. It's going to allow us to visualize whether there's degeneration in the disc, how much water content's in the disc, and if the discs have actually herniated out of their native position or where they're supposed to be in between the bones if they're pressing on nerves that come out of the back. Typically, if someone has a disc that is pressing on the nerve and the nerve is causing pain, we can correlate that to their pain and do further treatments to be more specific in what we're doing for the sciatica. It's a common problem. It's very treatable. The natural history of it, which means how does this problem behave if nothing were to be done, is quite favorable. Most people, 9 out of 10, will have an episode of sciatica resolve over the course of a week or two. Typically, physicians can help out quite a bit with pain medications, cortisone injections or cortisone by mouth, as well as anti-inflammatory medications to help to hasten the recovery or speed up the recovery from an episode. Again, if what we call neurological symptoms develop with numbness, tingling, and weakness, any sort of changes in urinary control, those symptoms mean that you need to get to a doctor right away.
All right. Joining me in the studio this evening is Dr. Randall Brewer with River City's Interventional Pain Specialists in Shreveport. We're discussing lower back pain, and you can call in this evening at 800-552-8502. David from Katy, Texas, has been waiting on hold. Thank you for being patient. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Okay. What I was calling about is I've had back problems for quite some time, both upper and lower. I've had and then anterior disc fusion on my cervical spine, 3 disc fused 10 years ago, and more recently I've had what the doctors referred to as nerve ablations, and I was really wanting to get your thoughts on the nerve ablations.
David, can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by nerve ablations, and are you talking back, or are you talking about the neck?
I've had it done both on my lower back and on my neck.
Okay. The term nerve ablations basically means that some sort of nervous structure is going to be ablated. Ablation means it's going to be lesioned in some way, which means damaging the nerve tissue. The rationale around nerve ablations is going to be that if a nerve is transmitting a pain signal from an area of the body that hurts to the brain and the spinal cord, if you cut that nerve, then that area is not going to hurt. And that's a common assumption that, okay, if the brain is feeling pain because of this nerve's activity, if we take the nerve out of the picture, then the brain's not going to feel the pain. That can help in certain conditions. The issue with nerve ablations in the spine is that the spine is what we would consider richly innervated. That means there's not a single millionth of a millimeter in the spine that doesn't have a rich system of nerves that's sensitive to any changes in the condition of the spine, except for some of the inside of the discs. And so what happens is when certain areas of the spine become inflamed, they cause pain, and nerve ablations around those areas can potentially help. The nerve ablations that are used most commonly, and I think you may recognize this term, are called radiofrequency ablations. Radiofrequency ablations typically are performed around the joints in the spine. The joints that I talked to Bill about earlier, the joints that are stiff in the morning, they may be more painful with standing and hyperextension, are called the facet joints. And typically, if the facet joints are a problem, they can be injected with nerve blocking medication, which is called a local anesthetic. Many people know it as Novocaine or lidocaine. If we inject around those joints and the pain goes away, even if it's only for an hour, then it gives us some indication that that joint is causing the pain. And so if that joint is causing the pain and we remove the pain by injecting around the joint, it would follow that maybe we can lesion the nerves around that joint and that will help the pain. And so the next step after the local anesthetic is put around the joint, patients will come back typically the next week or a couple of weeks later and they'll have a what we call a confirmatory injection done. And so we want to make sure that this is really where the pain's coming from. And so another injection of local anesthetic will occur around that joint. And again, if the pain goes away, even if it's for a short amount of time, it gives us some idea that this joint is part of the pain problem. Now the question becomes, is this joint all of the pain problem? If it's not all of the pain problem, how much of the pain problem is it? And so after that procedure is done, usually twice, then we come back and the nerve ablation is performed by putting a needle near the joint where small microscopic nerves pass from the joint into the bigger nerves that go ultimately into the spinal cord and the brain. So those microscopic nerves are embedded in tissue that's around the joint. They're embedded in connective tissue, and they run under what's called a periosteum, which is the lining of the joint itself. And so we test by performing electrical stimulation around the nerves to make sure it's only the small nerve that the needle tip is near, and it's not near a large nerve. And typically, the lesion will be created by what's called radio frequency energy, which basically means an active portion of an insulated needle gets hot for a period of time, anywhere from 60 to 90 seconds, and it basically produces a sort of a cautery type of lesion around that bone and ablates the nerve. Does this work? It works in a number of people in whom the joints are causing the pain. Now, how long does a nerve ablation last? I hear that question a lot, and basically it depends upon a number of factors. The area that is hurting can be re-injured. The area that's hurting also can have the nerves grow back, which basically means the pain returns slowly over time, and then typically another ablation can be performed. The other issue is if the pain was not from the joint and an ablation was performed, then the pain relief may not occur at all. Those are very good questions about the joint pains and the nerve ablations. I hope that that's been a satisfactory answer for you.
A very, very detailed explanation. We are doing our health matters this evening. Dr. Randall Brewer is my guest. We're discussing primarily lower back pain. And here's the number if you have a question, 800-552-8502. And this is an evening where we have storms through the area, and I know that the emergency alert system is popping in and out. However, the entire program is recorded, so if you miss a portion due to an alert about the weather, be sure to visit our website at redriverradio.org. And a little bit later on tonight, this program will be available to listen to and also to download. So again, our website is redriverradio.org. And the number to call if you have a question is 800-552-8502. One question that came in earlier from someone who didn't want to go on the air. Their question, this was anonymous from Shreveport. They wanted to know if back pain can be associated with gastrointestinal problems.
Can back pain be associated with gastrointestinal problems? Typically, when we hear about an isolated episode of back pain, we don't think about gastrointestinal problems unless other symptoms are present. Constipation, blood in the stool would be something that would be a major concern if that were present. A lot of times folks who do have what we call motility disorders of the intestines can have pain that is referred into the lumbar spine. In general, the initial workup for back pain that may be associated with some of the intestinal symptoms would be a thorough physical examination, and your primary care doctor would be the best doctor to initiate that workup. They would probably do some regular lab work, perhaps look at some of the electrolytes that could be associated with bowel disorders. The other thing to pay close attention to would also be a kidney problem. Many people who have kidney stones and things that are related to pain in the back would need to be investigated further by their primary care physician. The issue with an intestinal disorder causing back pain would be the symptoms are going to behave somewhat differently. And so if the pain in the back is coming from something that's deeper in the pelvis or in the abdomen, it may not be quite as positional. It may not radiate down the legs. Typically, it wouldn't. Standing and walking and sitting are probably not going to have nearly as much an effect on pain that's referred from the abdomen or the pelvis into the back.
Mm-hmm.
Those are sort of the symptoms that I would look for. And it's important to make sure that you give your doctor as much information as you can absolutely think about if you're concerned that your back pain could be coming from a source that's different from the conventional tissues in the back, such as the muscles and the nerves and the joints and the discs.
Our next caller from West Monroe, this is George. George, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I got a damaged tendon that comes out of your tailbone going down. About 4 days ago, I fell. Will this ever get any better or what?
George, thanks for your call. Sorry to hear about your fall. That condition can be quite painful, and I certainly hope that it does get better in a hurry. I would encourage you to see your primary doctor about that. Have your doctor do a thorough physical examination. It's not common, but that bone that's in the tailbone area can be fractured. It can actually be displaced. It's generally an area that's quite sensitive and can remain sensitive for quite some time. I think you probably would do fairly well with ice to start with. If your medical condition is such that you can take anti-inflammatory medications, your doctor may want to prescribe those as well. If an x-ray is performed and there is not a fracture, a lot of times just giving the tailbone some time to heal will be sufficient. Many people will feel better if they sit on a pillow for a number of days, especially a pillow that may be sort of shaped like a donut or have a depression in it such that there's not as much pressure placed on the tailbone. In your case, it's a fairly recent injury, and I would be very optimistic that with the appropriate management, it can be handled in a fairly efficient way and get you back to work.
Okay, our next caller from Shreveport. This is David. David, thank you for calling this evening. What's your question?
Hi, doctor. Good evening. I just wanted to know if there was any good data on taking PO or injectable steroids for osteoarthritis.
David, can you repeat what you said before the steroids for osteoarthritis?
Steroids by mouth or injection in treating osteoarthritis.
Okay, steroids by mouth or injection for osteoarthritis. Is there a particular area of osteoarthritis that you're inquiring about?
Hands and feet.
Hands and feet. Osteoarthritis and
possibly the hips. I mean, it seems that steroids are given out for those conditions, and I just wanted to know if there was any good data on that.
Okay. That's a good question. The data is basically much better for acute inflammation with steroids than it is for chronic inflammation. As a chronic management approach for osteoarthritis, injectable steroids or oral steroids are not commonly recommended, and the data is not good for that. The data is much better for non-steroidal treatment long-term, which would be drugs like ibuprofen or naproxen, Now, for what we would call acute management or a flare-up of osteoarthritis, especially in a larger joint like the hip or the knee, injectable steroids can be quite helpful to relieve inflammation within the joint. That's something that doctors and orthopedic surgeons and pain doctors will do from time to time. It's not what I would consider a maintenance therapy in folks who have chronic low levels of pain. Oral steroids have conventionally been used in other types of arthritis that have inflammation that's due to a disorder of the immune system. These disorders are called autoimmune diseases, and rheumatologists typically treat those types of arthritic conditions with steroids or other immune therapies that are directed towards the immune system in particular. Osteoarthritis from the chronic standpoint would not be treated efficiently with oral steroids or repeated injectable steroids? Very good question.
All right. We have another David. Actually, we've had several Davids this evening. I don't know if Davids are more more prone to lower back problems or not. But in any case, this is David from Pineville. Thank you so much for waiting. And go ahead with your question this evening.
Yes, Dr. Albert, if you could comment upon the efficiency of using the microcurrent machines such as the TENS machines and machines of this nature for low back pain.
David, thanks for your question. The use of electrical currents for pain has been around for a long, long time. There are different current strategies that are used. I think you may have mentioned TENS. It's an acronym that's spelled T-E-N-S. And it's transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. And basically, this is a distraction technique. And so if we, for example, if you burn your hand on the stove and you shake your hand, it doesn't seem to hurt as much. And so if we produce current in an area that is causing pain, it sort of mixes the signals in the system such that the pain is not as much of a problem. The thing that's associated with relief of with a TENS device typically is in folks who have pain that's relatively acute. From the chronic standpoint, some patients will benefit from using TENS therapy, and they basically can have a machine with pads that are renewable that can be used every day. It works for, I would say, the majority of patients in whom they have had a good response to it during an episode of physical therapy. If it doesn't work, some folks use different types of stimulation techniques such as alpha stimulation or other modalities that produce electrical current that may or may not help with the treatment. Now, if you have a TENS trial or a TENS unit put on in physical therapy or in your doctor's office and you don't necessarily achieve any pain relief in the immediate setting, they may want you to try it for a day or so at home before it's purchased. And if you go 24 to 48 hours with using it and you don't find an effect, it's not going to typically be a treatment that's going to have a long-lasting benefit. And it's also important to recognize that these therapies are not going to change anything about the underlying structures in the back that could be causing pain. And so before I recommend electrical therapy, or what you term microcurrent, I make sure I really understand where the pain is coming from. And it's certainly an option that doesn't involve surgery, it doesn't involve drugs or needles, and it can be quite helpful if it's used in the ways that I've talked about.
You're listening to Health Matters. I'm Kermit Poling. My guest is Dr. Randall Brewer. We're discussing lower back pain primarily this evening. Call us at 800-552-8502 if you have a question. Still about 15 minutes or so for some more questions. Laverne from Marksville, you've been waiting on hold here. Go ahead with your question this evening.
Yes, sir. I had surgery 4 months ago on L4 and 5. They fused my back.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been 4 months. I still have the same chronic pain. I did a myelogram yesterday. I'm in worse pain. And now they say I got a little nerve problem. They want to do epidural.
Laverne, thanks for calling in. That's a condition that's called post-surgical pain. It's only been 4 months since your operation. Laverne, if I could just ask you, is this your first back surgery, or is this a surgery that you've had after or is this a repeat surgery?
No, this is my first.
And how long did you have back pain before you decided to have surgery?
About 10 years.
Okay. And what you described as a fusion at L4 and 5, can you tell me more about that?
Put me a new bone in between 4 and 5. They fused it.
They put in new bone. Did they put any hardware, any screws or rods, metal plates, anything like that?
They put me a metal plate, two rods and some screws.
Okay, two rods and screws and a metal plate. And so what I believe you're describing is what's called a lumbar fusion surgery where the bones are basically prevented from moving. And the idea there is that if you prevent two bones from moving against one another and make them grow together, then they won't cause friction and won't activate the nerves that cause pain, and they won't hurt anymore. The reason that physicians decide to do a fusion is because there's what's called instability developing in the back, and that means that if the bones move too much in opposite directions, that they can actually push on nerve tissue and do nerve damage. Many times whenever a fusion is done to prevent nerve damage and to prevent progression such that the pain will get worse, tissue has to be moved and altered in order for the surgery to be successful. And so the screws have to be put in place. Bones have to be changed in a way such that they'll take the screws. And so whenever that occurs, it takes several weeks and months for the bone to grow, for the fusion to actually take, so to speak. Now, the nerves run between the bones. They run in between the screws. And many times whenever the nerves are hurting after surgery, it's something that can be treated with epidurals like you're describing. There are also medications that can be used to treat the nerve pain. Do I typically recommend epidurals for patients who have nerve pain after surgery? It's something that I've used quite often when the nerve is in an inflammatory state and we can't control the pain in other ways, such as with medication or with altering activities such as no excessive lifting or bending. The most important thing is to follow up with your surgeon. Talk to your surgeon about what you're experiencing. Make sure you get all of the information about your diagnostic test to see what other options they may be. Surgeons typically will not do another operation if the pain persists unless they've extinguished all other treatments, and the epidurals are a very common way to start. Right. I hope your problem starts to get better soon, and thanks for your call.
Is that unusual to be in pain that much longer after the surgery, 4 months?
Well, Laverne had pain for 10 years before her operation, yeah. So that means her back has been hurting a long time. And it's very, very common for people who have had a back operation after having back pain for such a long time to require some time to recover. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's difficult to look at data from back operations without knowing what the conditions specifically were and how long the pain was present.
Sure.
There's a phenomenon in the pain world, so to speak, that we call centralization of pain. And basically it's sort of the idea that the brain remembers. And so if the pain has been present at a level that is noticeable for the brain for a long period of time, the brain is sort of encoded with the pain signals, and it expects pain to be there all the time. So even if you take away the source of the pain is already encoded in the brain, and it can take much, much longer for the pain to go away in compared to the condition where the brain has not been changed by the pain.
Right. That's sort of like people who lose a limb or a hand or something like that, and they can still feel the sensation even long after they've lost it.
Absolutely. That's a common problem that pain physicians treat as well. It's called phantom pain.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-552-8502, the number to call with your question this evening for Health Matters for Dr. Randall Brewer. We're discussing lower back pain. Earlier, with all of the other calls, really, you've been talking about ways of treatment. Some of the ways, as you mentioned, with the electrical stimulation, the microcurrent, are very old. What are some of the more recent developments in the treatment of back conditions?
The most recent developments in the treatment of back conditions are refinements in surgical techniques. Spine surgeons are using a number of techniques now that are minimally invasive. The hardware that's used for spine surgery is much more advanced than it was when spine surgery was invented, so to speak. So surgical techniques and surgical materials have been advanced, and those advances occur very, very rapidly. The treatments for back pain in the non-surgical setting have not advanced as rapidly as the surgical treatments have. From the standpoint of, are we doing anything to change the incidence of back pain? Because that's really what we need to do that's new. Because 80% of us will have an experience of back pain at some point in our lives. And nearly half of us will have recurrent back pain, which means at least once a month, maybe once every other month, and some folks even once a week or so, we'll experience back pain to the level where we'll either take something for it or we'll change our activities. Many people really change their lifestyles as a result of back pain. They may or may not see a physician. The thing that's important for us to do moving forward is learn more about ourselves. What are we doing in our lifestyle? Are we maintaining an ideal body weight? Are we maintaining enough physical activity? Are we doing things that are smart for our health in general? And that's gonna help to prevent things like back pain.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of, when do we seek treatment? When do we image? Those are questions that are gonna be really important topics as our healthcare system changes in a way that's gonna be more efficient. And so from the standpoint of what's new, I think what we're gonna see in the next few decades is gonna be re-educating the public and making doctors and patients as well understand what elements of back pain really need an aggressive approach, what signs and symptoms mean a patient really needs to have an MRI study, mm-hmm. refinements in what surgical indications are. Those are the things that need to happen that are gonna be happening in the next several decades. I would say the newest thing from the non-surgical point of view, it's been around for about 30 years or so, but it continues to be in an evolutionary state, is gonna be called spinal cord stimulation and nerve stimulation for back pain or leg pain that's in the condition that a previous speaker, Hector, talked about, sciatica.
Mm-hmm.
Spinal cord stimulation is sort of the same effect that David was talking about with microcurrent, but it's stimulating the spinal cord directly. And so those nerve cells that remember the pain so long, like we talked about before, if we can sort of distract those nerve cells by sending electrical currents directly to them, a lot of folks will have enduring relief from that procedure. It's a simple procedure that's performed in the office in many cases, and then a small surgery is required to attach the stimulating device to a pacemaker. That technology advances. We've done a number of research studies looking at what's the best technology in that area mm-hmm. that's going to relieve back pain, relieve leg pain, relieve both. Can we relieve both sides of the back or both legs at the same time? The technology for everything in medicine is growing, and that's an area that's growing quite rapidly as well.
We have another person that just wanted to ask their question off the air. So here it is. Does inversion therapy really work?
Inversion therapy is basically a form of what we call traction. Inversion therapy is geared towards pulling the bones apart in the back. The treatment of traction with traction is something that's been around a long, long time. Inversion tables are sold to sort of produce that at home. There are a number of people who have inversion tables that speak very highly of them. Again, it's sort of like the question the previous caller had about, a mattress. Is a special mattress going to help? I would sort of put an inversion table in that same category. If you look at scientific data regarding traction in the low back, it doesn't look like it's any better than not doing traction at all. I would encourage you to get as much information as you can about the inversion table that if you're looking at buying one. And again, like we talked about with the mattress, if the supplier or the manufacturer is claiming that it helps for back pain, I would ask them for specific data and to get as much information as you can. It may be something that you would want to discuss with your primary care physician or your back pain specialist to make sure that your particular condition is one in which you could potentially try that out. Again, I would say it's a treatment that would be considered alternative therapy and not something that's supported by a large volume of scientific evidence.
You're listening to Health Matters this evening. The number to call with your question is 800-552-8502. My guest, Dr. Randall Brewer, with River City's Interventional Pain Specialists in Shreveport. And we still have some time for some calls. If we can get back to, you were talking basically about being preventional. A lot of people in office settings complain a lot about lower back pain. Do you have some suggestions specifically for those who, by nature of their jobs, they have to do a lot of sitting for most of the day?
The the first thing that comes to mind, and I remember during the last political campaign seeing pictures of a number of these folks who were sitting in cubicles and probably on the telephone for hours and hours and hours generating support for their candidate. And they were all sitting on exercise balls. And I thought, you know, that is a great idea for folks who have to sit for long periods of time because, you know, in our classes in the gyms, a lot of times an exercise ball will be used to strengthen the core muscles and to keep the back straight. If you don't, you fall off. And so it's something to consider. The other thing would be, you know, to take breaks, make sure that there's plenty of time for stretching before and after work, because what happens is in that seated position, the tendons that support the back and the hips, they're shortened because they're in that flex position, and so they're going to be typically painful when they're stretched out if they've been in that position for a long period of time. Just like if your arm's in a cast for several weeks, it's gonna take some time for those tendons to readjust. And so in office workers, I typically recommend that they take, you know, a good 5 to 10 minute stretching break and walking break, at least every couple of hours. You know, everybody needs a maintenance exercise program to strengthen the core is important in a number of folks. Cardiovascular exercise, most cardiovascular exercises engage the core muscles as well. There's a lot of evidence to support that a good core strengthening program, even in people who have had big back operations like Laverne, if they can get into a situation where they can strengthen their core, pay attention to how their back feels, not just when it hurts, but when it's feeling good. A lot of that muscle feedback will help to prevent further episodes of back pain exacerbations and flare-ups. But for someone who's highly motivated, I would encourage them to try the exercise ball, get into the gym, do some core strengthening, look at what their ideal body weight should be, strive to maintain an ideal body weight. Even folks, it brings another question. I think it was asked by me, by a patient maybe today or yesterday, you know, will losing weight make my back pain go away? Data has gone back and forth on whether or not weight loss will improve back pain. We know without a doubt that body habitus plays a role in larger joints such as the hips and the knees.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of patients who have lost weight and their back pain does improve. It is one of those conditions that once it develops, it's in a situation where it can be reactivated from time to time, because if the discs do lose their hydration and they have the propensity to crack, then the pain can recur.
All right. I think we have time to squeeze in just one more question. This is Bert calling from Benton, Louisiana. Bert, thank you for waiting on hold. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dr. Burr. The question is not really so much a question as it is a praise for back pain specialists. I've had two back surgeries already, and having gone to my back pain specialist, he has relieved my pain to the point to where we've been able to.
Go ahead. Well, I think we're on a cell phone. I think we lost Bert there on his cell. But there's one in praise of the home team. There you go.
Bert's praising his physician, and I would encourage you to let your physician know personally and about your praise for your back pain specialist. You know, if there is a benefit for back pain being so common, as you mentioned, Kerman, $50 billion a year in our healthcare system. It's the most common cause for lost days of work. Now that we're recognizing that this is a problem, it's not just a problem for some people some of the time. It can be a problem for most of the people and most of the time. And whether or not the treatments of back surgery, an injection, a nerve ablation, or an electrical stimulation device, it's always important to do your part in taking care of yourself. You know, that's going to mean talking to your doctor about the right exercise program. What can you do to maintain your health in all aspects of your life? And if it's required, you may need to have more of an aggressive approach to back pain. But in general, most people who suffer from back pain are going to get better if they do the right things for their health and they make sure that they don't rest an excessive amount of time with that acute episode. Because what I would encourage folks to do is to talk to their physician early and make sure that they keep moving as much as they can so that the back pain doesn't become a persistent problem.
Do you find that in your practice that a lot of your time is really spent encouraging people to do things to prevent, rather so that they don't have to come and visit you to begin with?
Absolutely. Those are the patients. You know, no news is good news. And I think from the standpoint of back pain prevention, it's something that many people put up with more than they really have to. And even if you go see a back pain specialist, and Bert, you certainly have high praise for yours, even if you just go see your back pain specialist to get better educated, reading the literature in their waiting rooms or talking to their nurses and folks that work in the office, even if you're going to the specialist to get educated, you know, that's a step in the right direction to understand more about back pain, more about your back in particular, and what can you do to continue to do the things that you really want to do and manage the back pain without having it manage you.
Well, my guest has been Dr. Randall Brewer with River City's Interventional Pain Specialists in Shreveport. Dr. Brewer, I want to thank you so much for being a part of the show this evening.
Thank you, Kermit. It's been a pleasure.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Wally Derleth and Daniel Gordy. I'm your host, Kermit Poling. I want to thank you for joining us this evening.